Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Hello, and welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, joined today by Danielle Rome, and one of our therapists here at the clinic, and James Johnson, our chief of chaplains. And our topic today is the importance of accurate diagnosis for effective treatment and recovery. And so, diagnosis. There's many questions around diagnosis. How do we get an accurate one? What's the importance? What's the risks? What's the dangers? Mm-hmm. Where do we want to start with this conversation?
Well, I think this is a relevant topic for our listeners, but also this is a conversation I have with patients all the time, especially when they first get here. Maybe they've had problems that they've struggled with for a long time, but they've never put a name to it. In our first sessions, we come up with a treatment plan, and the treatment plan is based off of whatever diagnosis either they've come in with or that they recently received either that day or the day before. And so we're processing, well, what does this mean now that these problems have a title? What does this mean to my identity? What does this mean to choices now that I have to make in my lifestyle that might help me live with this in a way that's healthier if it's something that's chronic, or what kind of treatments do I need to do? And so it impacts the way people view the rest of their lives, the way people view themselves in the moment and their past.
No, I want to expand what you just said in a moment, but I think as a foundation, as a physician, but not just as a physician, even if you think about the plan of salvation, accurate treatment starts with an accurate diagnosis.
Yes.
Because if your diagnosis is wrong, then your treatments are usually wrong.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. And so this is exactly why we want the most accurate diagnosis we can have. And we're going to talk primarily clinically, but this goes, and I want to put the seed in the back of our listening audience's mind. I don't think we're going to get off on this because I really want to resist, because I know I'd rather go talk about that. But it goes to the various atonement models that are out there. The atonement models are the explanation or the treatment plan for the sin problem.
Yes.
And depending on how you diagnose what the sin problem is, then you have an explanation to treat that problem. And so it's real important, even in that context, to actually say, okay, what's the problem that sin caused that the plan of salvation is designed to fix? And then you'll notice the explanations. If you actually look at the explanation, you can actually look back and see, well, here's the problem they're trying to fix with that.
Yeah.
But we won't get off into that. But this is the question. So let's talk about, before we get into the identity questions with your patients,
mm-hmm.
What do we mean by a diagnosis? And mm-hmm. What do we mean by a diagnosis?
Yeah. So a diagnosis is a title. It's a description, label of what the problem is based on a constellation of symptoms that are measurable and observable. So
okay.
We can see, okay, this combination of things, according to the way that we've agreed upon, means that this is what we would title it, and this is what the solutions might be.
So, yes. And where I'm going, I want our audience to understand, is there are the official, labeled, approved, what are called the DSM in mental health,
yep.
Diagnostic categories and diagnoses, mm-hmm. that have certain criteria that you must meet in order to be able to receive that diagnosis from your provider. That is one way people look at diagnosis. Oh, you've had, for instance, major depression. There's 9 symptoms that you have to have at least 5 of those over 2 weeks that impair function. And if you meet those 5 without exclusionary ones, there's certain things that if you have it excludes it, et cetera. And for instance, the symptoms are caused direct cause of a substance. Okay, then it excludes it. But if you meet that criteria, then you can be diagnosed with major depression, mm-hmm. for instance. And that's one way to look at diagnosis. And it's not wrong. And we do look at that, and we do that because this is a way, medical records work. We communicate between organizations, third-party payers look at that for reimbursement and validation of types of treatments that will be approved, and so forth and so on. There's a place for that. But it's the most superficial, and I want our audience to know that.
Yep.
When we diagnose somebody with a disorder, let's say depression, mm-hmm. we know that they have a dysfunction with at least 5 of 9 symptoms over at least a 2-week period. That's what we know.
Right.
We still don't actually know what's wrong with them.
Yes.
An accurate diagnosis, in my understanding, is a description of what actually is not just the symptom or disorder, but what are the various factors that are causal.
Yes.
So this person has depression because they're in an abusive marriage, they're B12 deficient, they have trauma issues unresolved, they have unresolved guilt issues, whatever they are. You're identifying the various contributing factors that result in the dysfunction. And so your diagnosis is this, also rooting back toward all the factors that led them to this place of dysfunction,
yeah,
so that you can then intervene across the landscape, biologically, psychologically, socially, spiritually, et cetera, to bring that person back into harmony with the laws of health so they thrive again. So when I think diagnosis, I'm going more than just a label.
Yes.
To the various underlying contributing factors. And as a person who, you know, designed for more, understanding that God designed us for more with design laws built into the fabric of reality, health problems come from being out of harmony with the laws of health.
Yes.
And so we're looking, this person's symptomatic, okay? The symptoms tell us what's the problem, what's the disorder. But now, where are they out of harmony with the laws of health? Because you can't have health while violating the laws of health, and you can't avoid getting healthy from harmonizing with them. So everything we do, whether it's cognitive therapy to bring truth to replace lies, whether it's spiritual stuff to resolve guilt and shame, whether it is nutritional to give the proper nutrition, sleep hygiene, exercise, whatever we're doing, we're moving a patient in harmony with the laws of health to bring healing to a person who's suffering. This is how I understand this idea. We're diagnosing, looking what's wrong and why it's wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay?
And I think about people who are different reasons people might seek out a diagnosis. And so usually that's something is wrong in their life. They're unhappy some way or something really bad has coming up. They're experiencing symptoms and behaviors, feelings that they don't like. And so they're looking for sometimes either it's something to make the pain or discomfort go away, or they're looking to see what's the problem so that I can know how to solve it. And so, but understanding some people that I've spoken to want a label to excuse them not working towards healing, but to excuse them staying where they are, rather than actually wanting to know what's wrong and what to do to fix it.
Thank you for saying, well done. Hold on. Let's categorize the answer to your opening question.
Okay.
Why do people seek a diagnosis?
Yeah.
Let's categorize. There's multiple reasons. Mm-hmm. One, some people want a diagnosis because they want to know what's wrong so they can bring an accurate treatment to get well.
Yep.
Some people wanted that for that reason.
Yeah.
Some people, though, want a diagnosis to help explain why they're dysfunctional so they don't have to get well.
Yes.
Oh, I've got, for instance, if you diagnose somebody with, I'm just trying to think of something.
Borderline personality disorder.
No.
Okay. I'm just throwing words at it that I know from travel.
No. Okay. You diagnose somebody, let's say, with
anxiety,
Down syndrome.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. That diagnosis would give explanation to certain both physical and mental processing features. Mm-hmm. And there's limited expectation for recovery and or transformation from the condition. That diagnosis is fairly a static condition. Now, they can have a meaningful life, but we don't anticipate an intervention that reverses the Down syndrome.
Right.
Okay. So some people, though, come with mental health problems, perhaps a borderline personality disorder, and they want to get the label so they can then function as if it's something like Down syndrome. Oh, I've got this, and that excuses me. Because we don't actually expect a Down syndrome person to get in some type of treatment where they're no longer Down syndrome.
Right.
And so some people are coming to get a diagnosis, so they then are not expected by others to ever improve.
Right. Yeah. And in some cases, I've heard people have actually been told by other clinicians that they're untreatable or that there are things that a specific diagnosis has no cure or has no treatment and that they just have to live with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe we should talk about some of those.
Yeah. Okay. So anxiety is one that I've had patients say, well, my goal here is to learn how to live with my anxiety. Or
So let's talk about that for a minute. Yeah. Let's just talk about that. Let's stick with that one for a minute and bring us back because we need to continue on that category. And I might derail us here. You know my view of anxiety. I've told our team
this.
Yes.
Yes.
But our audience may not know. My view of anxiety, despite the fact there are DSM diagnostic categories or disorders labeled with this, whether it's panic or generalized anxiety or PTSD, anxiety is actually a symptom. And anxiety serves to your mind the same function pain serves to your body. And when you have pain in your body, you don't initially go, oh, I've got a pain disorder. I need pain meds.
Yep.
You actually go, what's wrong? What's causing it? And you immediately seek to relieve yourself from the cause of the pain. And the more intense the pain, the more serious typically the problem, and the more urgently you address it to resolve it. Anxiety is the same way. It is to alert you something is wrong, and the higher the anxiety, it is to alert you that something serious is wrong to get you to take action quickly to resolve it. The problem is with, this is the danger of diagnoses, diagnosing someone with an anxiety disorder, however, can result in them thinking, oh, anxiety is not a symptom. It's a disorder that I will live with for the rest of my life. Yeah. This is almost never true. It's almost never true. Anxiety is almost always a symptom of something else. And if you deal with the symptom of whatever the something else is, just like physical pain, it mostly gets better. Now, is it true some people can get chronic pain disorders? Yes, because there's typically chronically something wrong. Arthritis with chronic pain, you have a chronic inflammatory condition that's contributing, your body's still signaling because it hasn't gotten better. People who have cervical spine disease or lumbar spine disease with ruptured discs and chronic back pain, it's because there's actually physiologically something wrong, sending a chronic pain signal that they can't fix.
Yeah.
Okay? But when it comes to anxiety, it's almost always fixable.
Yep.
And anxiety can be from a physical cause. People with hyperthyroidism, a thyroid out of control, can have panic and anxiety. You treat the thyroid, it goes away.
Yep.
People with sleep apnea can wake up with panic in the night because they're actually getting hypoxic or feeling that they're suffocating and it's triggering anxiety. And then that can actually lead them to be afraid to go to sleep at night.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to have that again. But the anxiety is telling them there's something wrong and they need to treat that. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so,
absolutely.
And our trauma patients who have lots of anxiety have anxiety because they have their anxiety with their nightmares or intrusive thoughts keep coming up or flashbacks because their mind is saying, you've got a wound, pay attention to it, heal it. It's unhealed. You haven't healed this yet.
Yeah.
And if you heal it, then this stuff resolves.
Yes.
So, but yeah, so I think the DSM, this is the risk of the diagnostics are that giving somebody a diagnostic label then can cause them to form an identity.
Yes.
I'm a broken person. I've got a disorder. This is something I have to live with. And then I'll get on a pharmaceutical for the rest of my life and be, you know, symptomatic forever.
Yep.
Or to excuse it, a destructive behavior. Like, worked with a couple one time that one of the spouses went and got a diagnosis for what was causing them to be dysfunctional in the marriage and basically had no impetus at that point to work to change because their excuse was always, well, see, this is the way I am. So you just have to love me the way I am rather than. And so that makes sense that you would say that's dangerous. I mean, that's just what popped in my mind. I can see where that would be a struggle relationally with people.
So one reason people want to get diagnosed is for they want to get well.
Yeah.
They want to know what's wrong, want to get well. Other times they want to have a certain relief of responsibility so they can stay dysfunctional and everybody else has to adapt to them.
Yep.
Okay. And sometimes people want a diagnosis for compensation purposes.
Mm.
They want to get diagnosed so they can get on disability.
Mm.
Yeah.
And or of some kind. That's real, folks.
Oh, very much, yes.
Which some people, I would say, would need that. So that's, we're not going to make a blanket statement that that's a bad thing.
There are
thing,
people
right?
that abuse the system, and sadly, that should be there
but
for people that need it.
Can we clarify that we're not saying that's an inherently bad thing for people to get diagnosed so that they can get disability? Or is that always problematic?
No. So I don't see people who have diagnoses that are legitimate, that cause them to be disabled and need support, actually seeking it for the support. They're seeking the diagnosis. No, seriously. Let's say somebody that's hallucinating, schizophrenic, delusional. Do you think that person is going, I need to get a diagnosis so I can get support? Or do you think that person is going, I want a diagnosis because I want to know what's wrong so they can fix me because I'm tired of having hallucinations. I don't want to be delusional anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. So they want to get fixed.
Right.
Okay. They want to get well. That's the first category. But if the condition is such that it's not amenable to treatment and they have chronic dysfunction, then as a compassionate society, the diagnosis helps them get support. But the person actually isn't actually seeking to get the support. They're only needing the support because what they're actually seeking is not achievable, which is wellness.
So do you ever see people come?
You see the difference there. So I'm not saying that people who are on support, some type of disability because of a actual, some type of, you know, disability support check because of actual disability. I'm not saying that's bad.
Right.
I'm saying that there, but that wasn't their motive for getting the diagnosis. Their motive was, there's something wrong with me, fix it. I'd rather be healthy.
Okay. But people that are abusing the system in an attempt to.
They want a diagnosis because they actually want to get support.
Excuse.
See the different motives there.
Yes.
Okay. But thank you for clarifying that because I didn't want somebody who was on support thinking that we were saying that that's what they pursued. No.
Exactly.
No. Yeah. If you're on legitimate support, I know you would prefer to actually have wellness and have health and be glad to be rid of all of that.
Yeah.
But we're happy that we live in a society where you can have the support you need if you've got a disability. But there are people who actually will interfere with recovery. They have, and there's two categories there. There's those who are malingerers who are faking it all to get, and there are people who have a real illness of some sort. They magnify their illness and interfere with their own recovery because they want the support.
Yeah. Yep. And unfortunately, we have seen that.
Yeah. Okay. So that's what I was. So the reasons people pursue diagnosis, and then. Are there reasons that people pursue diagnosis for third parties? Family members want family members diagnosed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or I've seen parents want their children diagnosed in order to explain the problem instead of taking accountability for what roles they might be playing in the child's dysfunction.
So this is a well-known dynamic where children and adolescents will often present to a mental health facility or provider with dysfunction. They're acting out.
Yes.
But if you actually look at the home in which the child is living, the pathology is actually originating in the parents. But the child is often the healthiest member, and they're the ones who are basically pleading for help through their symptomology.
Yeah.
And yet the parents are not, you know, willing to look in the mirror and get themselves dealt with.
Yeah.
And so they externalize away their pathology and want the child to carry the baggage of the family dysfunction.
Yes. And I've even had adult patients who that's their backstory is when they were, you know, they'll say, well, I've had anxiety disorder and depression since I was diagnosed at 8 years old or 10 years old. And my poor family has had to deal with me. And now my spouse has to deal with me and all this stuff where it's, okay, there is more going on than you were born with this problem.
Yep.
And like, there is more there. But people have then, because they got that diagnosis at such a young age, which diagnosis at a young age is not always a bad thing, but because they got that diagnosis, they've now internalized that as part of their core identity as, this is how I am. This is how I will always function. This is...
Let me rephrase what you said. This is not how I am. This is
who
I am.
Yes, who I am. Yeah. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that actually is very, in my view, unhealthy.
Yes.
So for a person to internalize as part of their identity a diagnosis, for instance, it is healthy for somebody to say, I have seizure disorder, if they have one.
Yep.
I have diabetes.
Yep.
It's not healthy to say, I am seizure disorder, I am diabetes.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
But when it comes to anxiety, they will often do this. I am this, you know, I am, I am anxiety almost is what they're saying.
Yeah.
Or I am anxious.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay?
Or I am borderline.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. And that's part of who their sense of self is. And then the world revolves around that identity performance almost rather than wellness, because if that's who they are, well, then who are you if you no longer have those problems?
Exactly. Well, who are you if you were to get better or to heal? And in some cases, people will come in where they've had a diagnosis for a really long time that Maybe it was a misdiagnosis. They get here, their diagnosis has changed. And then when we're having our first session, some of what we're processing is, okay, I've thought I'm this way for years and years, and now this isn't the case anymore.
Yeah. So let's talk about that misdiagnosis now. We talked about the importance of an accurate diagnosis and the reasons why people can pursue them. In psychiatry, misdiagnoses are common.
Yes.
Misdiagnosis, when you think of a misdiagnosis, most people think of wrong diagnosis, but a misdiagnosis can be on either side of that equation where you give somebody a diagnosis they don't have, or you don't give them a diagnosis that they do have. You missed it. Mm-hmm. Okay, a misdiagnosis. And one of the most common is bipolar disorder, which I've seen reports in the literature that bipolar disorder is misdiagnosed 70% of the time.
Wow.
70% of the time it's misdiagnosed.
Wow.
On both sides. People with it not being diagnosed with it, people without it being diagnosed with it.
Yep.
And that's because the bipolar diagnosis, there's a whole range of mood instability, different diagnoses,
yep.
And people will often get them confused and give diagnoses that don't belong. And sometimes when a person has been diagnosed with a certain disorder, we had a patient, you know, recently that had a diagnosis that was no question in my mind, they did not have that diagnosis. But that diagnosis provided them great insulation from any personal responsibility for their hysterical acting out and childish behavior.
Mm, yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah.
And when I told this person they don't have that diagnosis, they were not happy.
Yeah.
They were not, oh, you mean I don't have cancer? Okay. Metaphorically speaking.
Yeah.
And there was no relief. There was actual anger and denial and disdain for me.
Yeah.
Because that diagnosis was valuable to them. Because that diagnosis, they threw up every time they had a tantrum.
Yeah.
Every time they wanted to manipulate their environment, they threw the diagnosis up and everybody had to defer to them.
Yep.
And if you took that away, then they would actually have to mature and grow up.
Yep.
They'd have to own it. Mm-hmm. But now it's not their fault.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yep.
So
then what leads to, I mean, 70% of the time, that's a lot. And you mentioned, is it just because there are just so many things in the DSM that can be used? Or are there like common errors that tend to happen to create misdiagnosis?
For bipolar or anything.
Okay, well, okay. Well,
so many diagnoses have overlapping symptoms.
Okay.
They're overlap. So for a person, for instance, major depression, symptoms of depression include things like alteration in sleep, alteration in appetite. And when I say alteration, because it would be high or low.
Yeah.
Alteration in appetite, alteration in concentration, alteration in a sense of joy, feelings of worthlessness or guilt, suicidal thoughts. Those are part of the symptom complex of depression. It's not the only thing that can have those symptoms.
Yeah.
There are a wide variety of disorders where people can have symptoms like that, okay? And so you it really does take some sophistication. You can't just pull out a DSM or a checklist box and make diagnosis. It's part of understanding the person's presentation and their history, their personality structure, their functional level, other contributing factors. With bipolar, though, there is at least one innocent and actually you could knowingly misdiagnose, knowingly, because you're restricted. And that is, you've got a patient whose first presentation for first treatment of any symptom is a severe depression. They have a strong family history of bipolar disorder, and their depression symptoms are consistent, more consistent with a bipolar depression than a unipolar depression. But they've never had a manic or hypomanic episode in their life yet.
Yep.
You cannot give them by rule, you cannot give them a bipolar diagnosis. Yep. Even if you're highly suspicious, their initial presentation is bipolar because by definition, bipolars require a hypomanic or manic episode and they haven't had one yet. But you're suspicious, they're an undeclared bipolar who will in the future have one. So that would be a system innocent required And the reason for that is, I mean, you can understand why. There are you can be suspicious. Not everybody from a family with a family bipolar actually develops bipolar. Then it would be unfair to diagnose them based on your suspicion before they've actually had the symptoms to meet the criteria. Yeah. But some of those will ultimately end up bipolar, and they start out as major depression.
And then there's a risk there because some antidepressants can trigger mania. And so if you give them the diagnosis...
Only in people vulnerable.
Really.
Right. But if you give them the diagnosis of depression, give them a medication you know is safe, and then send them on their way, they might go to another person that doesn't assess for history of bipolar
family. Put them on antidepressant and then flip.
And then, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's tricky.
Do you find that, and if you're uncomfortable with it, and maybe this isn't a good question, but... A lot of people in this day and age, they know they've got a problem. They go on the internet. They go to one of these websites that lets you put in your symptoms, and they spit you out, this is what you've got. Do you find that that impacts like your practice? Or, I can realize that that's just guesswork on side of a quiz, but I wonder how many people walk in or live their life thinking, I have these symptoms, this website is trustworthy, I have this condition. Does that impact the way you guys do your practice? Do you run into that at all?
I've mostly seen that with people with identity issues, okay. Is that they're looking for someone to tell them who they are. And so they're potentially not actually wanting to get better or not actually wanting to get help. Because if you want help, you go to a doctor to help you figure out what the problem is. But if they're looking at it online, what I've seen a lot of the time, not all of the time, is trying to come up with maybe an excuse or an explanation or an identity. I see this a lot in adolescents and younger adults, specifically through TikTok. There's even trends of diagnosis. I don't know if you know about this.
No, I haven't had much of the online. Very, very
okay.
Cool.
But there's trends. So like dissociative identity disorder was a trend for a year. So when I was working with adolescents, we had a lot come in that would say, yeah, I have DID. And a couple that would pretend and act like they had it, but not based on what was actually DID, but pretend based on what TikToks they had seen about it. And it, you know, and so it, so that is something that I've seen, but that in and of itself can be helpful. Like, oh, okay, you went out of your way to seek this explanation. Let's talk about why. Let's talk about what you were experiencing, why you wanted that, why you felt like that was something that you needed to do. And that can help us learn more about what the actual root is as well.
So I haven't seen very much of the online self-diagnosis as an issue. What I have seen as a frequent issue is coming with diagnoses from other providers before they arrive. They've actually seen another provider.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they come in with an expectation because of what they've been diagnosed by another provider. And I will tell you, just like in any field you go to, whether it's an auto mechanic, whether it's a contractor, whether it's a preacher, whether it's a musician, does everybody who's a musician, a contractor, a preacher, do they all have the same skill? Or do you find there's a wide range of competencies?
Yeah.
Same thing when it comes to mental health providers. There's a wide range of diagnostic skill and competency. Mm-hmm. I never accept a diagnosis that comes to me. I hear that history. I read those histories. I always take my own history and do my own assessment and make my own diagnosis. Now, there's many times I agree. Yeah, that's consistent. Yep, that diagnosis fits. There's many times I don't, that I think that they were misdiagnosed in some way. Yeah. And I end up making my own diagnosis. And that's where you can have some pushback when they, especially as we talked earlier, if they have a long investment in this diagnosis and they've had lots of treatment for this diagnosis and it's not the diagnosis and then you can have to have a long explanation as to why I think that's the case and here's what I think was really going on. At the end of the day though, and then there are some individuals, since we're talking about diagnosis, there are some individuals who are resistant of the accurate they don't want the label. Whether it's bipolar and they don't want the label bipolar,
yeah.
Whether it's borderline personality disorder, whatever it might be, there's some people when you tell them the diagnosis, they're very resistant to that. And to me, at the end of the day, the diagnosis is what the diagnosis is as far as the label goes. But I tell my patient, it doesn't really matter what you call it. We could call it up and down syndrome.
Yep.
Instead of bipolar. We can call it high-low syndrome. It doesn't matter what we call it. At the end of the day, it has this symptom cluster, this pattern of behavior, this ability to interfere with your function in this way, as your history and symptoms have demonstrated over this period of time. And you have the option to recognize, no matter what we call it, this is something that's real in your life, and you can treat it or not.
Yeah.
If you don't treat it, then these are the projected likely outcomes. If you do, we can actually significantly mitigate these symptoms and these dysfunctions in the future to give you a much more successful future life. So I try to not have an argument over the label.
Yep. Yeah.
And actually focus on the functional realities of their experience that they themselves are not happy with, and we'd like to resolve them. How do we get there?
Yep.
The potential real-world downside of diagnosis, though, is that it can have real consequence. There are certain jobs you will not be able to do with a bipolar diagnosis.
Yeah.
On certain meds, you can't do them. Now, they're like airline pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's one. Well, I don't know too many others, but that's one.
Interesting, yeah.
Well, you probably will have a difficult time getting a Secret Service clearance with a bipolar diagnosis.
Yeah.
I'm pretty certain that's true, too.
Yep.
Okay, so there's certain diagnoses. Now, it is not true that a professional nurse, doctor, lawyer will lose their license with a diagnosis. They won't. They can keep their license and practice.
Yeah.
Okay, that's true. But some people fear the consequence. They fear the stigma. They fear people finding out.
Oh, yeah. And I was not sure when you were providing psychiatric care in the military, if you encountered a lot of that. But I've been glad to see in recent years a broadening acceptance. So that used to be the stigma, that soldiers would come to me and say, if I go to the counselor, the therapist, the psychiatrist, and they give me a diagnosis, my military career's over. And they were refusing to get help because even though it was hurting their life, hurting their families, they didn't want to lose their military career. Was that something you ran into when you were still practicing in the military?
So yes, the lower ranking soldiers would come. The senior NCOs with a career and the officers would not. They would not come to a military provider. If they needed help, they would go to a private provider outside the military that had confidentiality and the military would not know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense. So looking at, from if I understand you right, there's overlapping symptomologies that might cause misdiagnosis. What do you tell somebody who has been to maybe multiple providers and they're on their second or third diagnosis and they're wrestling with, even though they want to get better, they're wrestling with this idea of trusting their provider? Because here you are, I've had however many different answers to my problem. How can I trust you or the system or the clinic or whatever? Is it similar to what you were saying?
So your question, I want to clarify, is your question, they've had two or three diagnoses and our position is several of those are wrong versus they've had two or three diagnoses and they were all right. For instance, a person can have generalized anxiety disorder and major depression, or PTSD and major depression and ADHD. Mm-hmm. They can have all three.
They all can be present.
Yeah, they can all be present at the same time. Or they can have generalized anxiety disorder, dealt with stuff, they've resolved, they're not really, and then had depression later in life at a different time. So you can have several diagnoses either sequentially or simultaneously. There are certain ones that are, in my view, if you have one, it rules out the other. Okay. For instance, in my view, if you actually have trauma PTSD symptomology, I don't also give a generalized anxiety disorder diagnosis because those anxiety symptoms are subsumed in the larger PTSD diagnosis.
Okay. Okay. So it's possible for a person who comes into a clinic to say, well, I've been diagnosed with this before and you're telling me I have this, and you can explain to them, of course, they can kind of go together. They have overlapping symptoms and restore that trust.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
It's also people have to choose to trust to a certain extent. Like when you come into a place like this, it's understandable if you've had really bad experiences and you're not fully trusting right away. I totally get that. But you're here now. Do you want to work together, see if I'm trustworthy, and collaborate to come up with a solution? Or are you going to stay stuck and not take the risk of getting better?
Yeah. So one of the things is explaining it, not declaring it, explaining it and why.
Yeah.
Here's why you, and this is what this means, and these are the criteria. And if you have a person who is actually fairly reasonable, if you give the explanations to why you think this is a diagnosis and what the actual diagnosis means and where this comes from, what's happening, not just the declaration of it, then I've not really had much problem with people accepting it, unless there are ulterior things going or other things going on. And I say that with the exception of certain predictable ones that have a early, late adolescent, early 20s, first time bipolar disorders with mania. It's fairly common that after the manic episode clears, they don't want to accept the diagnosis of bipolar. And they will make an excuse. Well, that was because I was smoking marijuana. That was because I pulled three-night all-nighter for my college exams. That was because I drank two pots of coffee on a road trip with my friends. And they'll have something they'll point to because they really don't want to have the diagnosis bipolar, even though you have a full manic episode with psychosis and hospitalization. They want to be able to attach it to something they did, and this is a one-off. And so it's very common with first episode manic patients that they will initially deny it. It's very common. And typically it takes two and sometimes three psych hospitalizations before they finally accept it. It's not uncommon. I've seen that repeatedly. And so I work very hard and give them long explanations on what the psychotic and manic episodes are doing neurotoxic-wise to their brain, and really strongly advise. But even with those good explanations, they're so invested in their identity to not want to have this diagnosis that they resist it and deny and make another explanation for themselves. And it's based off of real hope and a wish and a dream.
Yeah.
So have you seen that too?
Yeah.
I think that's about the number one place I see that.
Yeah.
People are much less likely to deny depression than the manic episode.
Yeah. I've also seen people deny PTSD because they don't want to hold accountable, or they don't want to admit that the person or people that caused them the trauma.
Now, where I've seen a lot of people doing the online self-diagnoses, this is about the only time I see it. I'm going to say the only, but about the only time, is the ADHD self-diagnoser.
Okay.
They will come in a lot. And the problem with that is there's a lot of ADHD mimickers out there. Yeah. Anything that interferes with your prefrontal cortex, anything, will cause distractibility, lack of focus, concentration problems, impulsivity, moodiness. All the symptoms of ADHD happen anytime the prefrontal cortex is impaired. And so you can cause anybody to look like they're ADHD simply by sleep depriving them. So sleep deprivation until they get back on their normal sleep routines will cause people to not. And if you've ever traveled internationally and been seriously jet lagged, you are not going to want to sit down and study one of your college courses or take an exam. It's not because you can't focus. You can't stay on because your prefrontal cortex is extremely fatigued. So
you're saying like a student in high school who has a parent that lets them stay up all night watching on a screen and they're not sleeping at night, they're being constantly
They will look like ADHD and they might get on a stimulant.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. And so this is where you know, there are a lot of ADHD mimickers out there.
Yes. Yeah. I've even heard people say, well, I can't sleep, or I only sleep this many hours. And they leave out the fact that they're sitting in bed on their phone.
Right.
And they say, well, I can't go to sleep. Like, well, but you're on your phone. Well, I can't stop being on my phone because I don't want to get off my phone. Therefore, I can't sleep. There are a lot of people that genuinely believe that that means they can't sleep because they don't want to get off the phone. Yeah. Yeah.
So if I hear what you're saying, right, there are a plethora of reasons a person could get misdiagnosed. It might be, you know, an internal problem where they don't have an identity issue. It could be that the diagnosis changes over time throughout their life, multiple symptoms. It could be that there were overlapping symptoms. And so when we look at all of this, I guess, man, how do you help somebody have hope whenever they're saying, man, there's all these things that could, you know, how do I know that I'm actually going to get the right treatment?
I don't know that I could. That question is like saying, how can you know you're going to get anything in the future? Mm. You asked a future question.
Yeah.
I can't answer future questions. Okay. How can I know what they're going to get from somebody else? I can't know that.
Yeah.
So that question is a setup to discourage them.
Okay. Well, I guess what I'm thinking is if they walk
if
in.
If you would rephrase it and say, is it possible for me to get effective treatment that can improve my life? Yes. How can I know you're going to get it? I can't know that.
Okay. Well, that's an important. I'm thinking of what patients might ask me mm-hmm. when they have some of their doubts about the process. You know, we say things like, oh, trust the process. And they'll say, well, what about this? What about that? And I was just trying to think of how to respond to them with care to say, you know, can't know anything for certain, but if you, you know.
You know, effective treatment is out there for people who engage in it. You can't get health while violating the laws of health, and mm-hmm. you can't avoid the health benefits of harmonizing. Yeah. So accurate diagnosis and then engagement in interventions that restoring you towards health across the domains of your being will result in healing and improvement. Okay. There are some disorders that I don't expect a high likelihood of what you might call cure, like schizophrenia.
Yeah.
Cure, meaning they don't have the problem anymore and they don't need treatment anymore. But at least a third of people with schizophrenia, if you get them on the right meds, their symptoms resolve and they do very well long-term.
Yep.
Okay. So it's treatable. This and those who have chronic relapsing forms, you can still mitigate the intensity of those symptoms and improve the quality of their life with treatment, where they can actually organize and plan and live and engage. Okay, I've had chronic schizophrenics who are on disability, but they have a meaningful life. They're organized. They know where they're at. They interact with their families. They have a little pet they love. But they can't handle a lot of stress, so they're not employed because that causes psychotic decompensations. But they're not psychotic in a very healthy, structured environment and on their meds. But without that, they might be homeless, disorganized, chaotic, hallucinating.
Yeah.
That makes sense?
It's perfect.
So that's a very, very severe neurobiological condition. Most of the stuff we treat here have components of biology and psychology and spirituality. And what God promises people here and now, and you know this, is a new heart and right spirit.
Mm-hmm.
We do not get promised new biology until mortal puts on immortality and corruption puts on incorruption, the second coming. But we can have a new mind, the mind of Christ, a new heart, where we can have peace with God, peace with ourselves, and we can have the principles of God and how we govern ourselves internalized, and that will always result in better mental and emotional health, always, and maturity of character.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hmm?
Yeah.
And so if they ask the question, I would say that you can find effective treatment. I don't know of really any that we don't have any effective treatment for.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Full bore diagnosed Alzheimer's disease and dementia. Okay. If somebody has dementia, Alzheimer's dementia, we don't have a treatment to rebuild the billions of neurons that have died.
Yeah.
But if somebody has a family history of Alzheimer's dementia, there's absolutely intervention that can prevent the vast majority of people of getting Alzheimer's disease, because it's a lifestyle related stuff.
Yep.
Okay. It's if you do the healthy things before you get demented, you can prevent your brain for the Alzheimer's form anyway, of getting demented, unless you have a very rare form, less than 5% of familial early onset that happens before age 60. But the late onset form is almost always lifestyle related. And you change your lifestyle, do the healthy stuff. Even if you have a family history, you're not going to get demented. That's what the data shows.
That's amazing. That's
really cool.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. All right. Anything else or questions about diagnosis?
This is comforting because, you know, you guys said some of that stuff, it made me kind of very antsy. But when you make it to where we've got a good team, it's going to give a solid diagnosis, it's going to give you a treatment plan that works, and there's hope. That's really encouraging.
Yeah. I think the piece I just want to really highlight, and this is a conversation I have a lot, is the identity piece. And that this is not, if somebody listening has recently gotten a diagnosis or had a diagnosis changed, it's not who you are, right? It doesn't change the problem. It explains the problem.
And that's separating character from illnesses.
Yes.
Who you are. Are you an honest person, kind, loyal, faithful, true, dishonest, manipulative, exploitive? I mean, that defines who you are. Who you are. Child of God, reborn, living a godly life. You can do that with bipolar disorder. You can do that with, struggling to overcome anxiety problems.
Yep.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. Working through your trauma issues. So your character can heal, even, and if schizophrenics, I have schizophrenics, honest, loyal, kind, reliable, okay, people. So their character can be mature while they are still operating in a body that may be struggling with various symptoms. Absolutely. And so separating the disorder from who they are.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, we hope you enjoyed the program today. If you have questions, send those in to questions@designformore.net. Questions@designformore.net. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.